In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. My name is Geert, and I am your host for today on NBN's Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery podcast. And we are very happy to be joined by Professor Stefan Snelders to discuss his new book, Drug Smuggler Nation, Narcotics and the Netherlands, 1920 to 1995. Welcome, Stefan.
Welcome. Thank you, Geert.
Great that you're here. Professor Snelders, Stefan, is an historian, and he has published extensively on many topics, such as the history of psychoactive substances, pirates, the history of medicine in former colonies, and the assertivity of medical patients over time. His current appointments are as a research fellow at the Descartes Center for the History and Philosophy of Science and at the Freudenthal Institute, both located at the Utrecht University in the Netherlands. Drug Smuggler Nation was published February 2021 with Manchester University Press, and the book provides an overview of the relationship between the criminal drug economy in the Netherlands and the drug regulatory regime as maintained by the Dutch government since 1920. There is a lot of material. It ranges from anecdotes on romanticized cannabis entrepreneurs via the Dutch police's co-management of crime together with the Chinese triads, all the way to theory-building explanations of why the Dutch drug underworld is not really like a rigid hierarchical pyramid, but consists instead of an entrepreneurial criminal anarchy. Now, Stefan, before we dive into the book's contents, could you tell us a bit more about what brought you to the current subject with this specific angle? And is there a reason why you decided to write it now?
Well, the field of drug history is fairly new. It came really into existence in the 1990s. And at that time, I was involved in doing my PhD on a subject from the history of drugs that was on the history of LSD in the Netherlands. And from there on, I became interested in the career paths of other drugs. But until a few years ago, I was always very much working on the demand side of drugs and not so much on the supply side. So I problematized our dealing with drugs in Dutch society and elsewhere, but I never posed myself the real question of what is the role of the supply side in this. So like many people, I just presume that a drug, even if it's illegal, it will be supplied in some way by a criminal underground or otherwise, and that's it. But then I started to become more interested in global phenomena, global trade routes, also in the context of other projects I did on colonial history. And it became obvious at some point that the trade routes for illegal drugs nowadays were almost the same as they had been used for centuries. For instance, the ones used by the great Dutch trading companies or the famous Silk Road from Asia. And I was wondering that these trade routes kept on being in existence, even while the trade itself changed its character, for instance, from legal to illegal. And that led to some discussions at the university I worked at, Utrecht University, as you already said. And then they actually asked me, why don't you delve deeper into this phenomenon and try to establish why it is that, for instance, the trade routes of the Dutch East India Company in the 1600s are so much similar to the trade routes of criminal entrepreneurs and the illegal drug economy nowadays. And this led me to the fascinating world of the supply side, which turned out to be peopled with all kinds of characters, groups. Some of them you can romanticize, some of them you rather not. But also the whole geographical lines around the globe were also peopled with distinct cultures, cultures of smuggling, cultures of criminality. And that really fascinated me, that the geography went together with the culture to give or to prolong the existing trade routes. So that there, although there are many differences, of course, in the course of the centuries, the commonalities are also very striking. So why did we decide to do this now? This was part of a much bigger project, and that has to do with the development in Dutch drug policies. So since the 1970s, the Netherlands have always had the reputation of being a very tolerant country towards drugs. Amsterdam is seen as a kind of paradise for everyone who wants to get high. But over the last 10 or 15 years, the Netherlands have become more conservative, and there are increasing attempts to limit the tolerance in the Netherlands also, for instance, in the coffee shops, but also on other in other territories. And this led us to think, okay, but maybe this tolerance of the Netherlands is also something of a distinct historical period. Why don't we get deeper into this from all kinds of angles, including the supply side, and find out what has really driven Dutch drug policies and where will they go? And this also went along with the increasing concerns in our society about the subversion of the Dutch state by the criminal underground. So this also posed the question, is this something new? Is this something much more dangerous than it used to be? How this connects to the rest of society, etc. So it also seemed like the moment to further investigate these matters and publish on them.
That's really interesting, yeah. And I would... I mean, you say that society is becoming more conservative, perhaps, but repression against the supply side has always more or less been in place. I think you indicated in the book, right?
That's one of the great myths of Dutch drug policies, And that's also often been used as a kind of rhetorical device by other countries, France, Germany, or the United States, that the Netherlands have not all only been tolerant about drug use, but also about drug supply. While in actual fact, since the introduction of the drug regulatory regime about a century ago, the Netherlands have always been very keen on fighting against the large-scale drug trade, large-scale smuggling, also the large-scale production of, for instance, Dutch homegrown marijuana, the so-called nederwiet, and Dutch synthetic illegal drug industry. It is true that the Netherlands have left the small users alone, but they've always wrestled with the question, how do we tackle the problem of the big suppliers?
Yeah, I figure. And maybe related to this, I mean, something we often hear in discussions on drug market economics is that the price of narcotics remains artificially high because of strict regulation, which intuitively sort of makes sense. Because, well, the risk of incarceration seems like something that's likely to become part of the product's price. But you indicate this is not really the case. Could you maybe tell the listeners how that relates to this crucial concept that you name in the book of criminal anarchy?
Yeah, so this is about the political economy of the drug, of the drug market. So if you take the older position that illegal drug markets will tend to develop in the same way as, for instance, the beer market, which is monopolized by a few brewers and Heineken in particular, or coffee markets, where a few players increasingly dominate the market, and therefore also can make prices artificially higher, stuff like that. And if you combine it with the idea that because of the illegal character of the drug market, it is dangerous to operate it on it. So drugs will actually be in a scarcer supply, and that would also be an indication for raising prices. So this is the old view of the illegal drug markets, which was very much around in, say, the 1980s. But actually, we see now that this is totally not the way the illegal drug markets have developed. They didn't get monopolized by a few big players. Prices didn't go up, at least in the Netherlands they didn't. For instance, the price of ecstasy of MDMA is today far lower than it was in the early 1990s. Prices of heroin and cocaine have, with some fluctuations, been kept stable. And also the market has not become dominated by a few players, but instead by a fluid combination of all kinds of suppliers, smugglers, and networks in different alliances and different combinations. And actually, the illegal character of the drug market, rather than stimulating high prices and monopolization, has done the reverse thing in the Netherlands. And this is where the concept of criminal anarchy comes in. Anarchy is taken here as a kind of organizational model, a flat and flexible organizational model with no real hierarchy, in which people can easily split off from each other, make new alliances. And you see, this is actually a far more difficult kind of organization to fight against for law enforcement than if they would just have to dismantle great hierarchical organizations and take out the big leaders. And you can see, for instance, in the Colombian cocaine trade, that it didn't really matter much that at a certain point they were able to kill Pablo Escobar. Much was made of it, but it didn't affect, I would say, the cocaine trade at all. It didn't increase prices. It didn't lead to scarcity of the market. So this is not the way that works. So you have a flat... You have flat models. That also means that you have... So why does a flat model actually means that you don't have monopolization and you don't have a tendency to higher prices? So these are small groups. So it's actually very difficult for them to control the whole market. They are not so much involved in territorialization. So the idea that a drug cartel also actually in a physical way controls a certain territory, like in the way we think about Mexican drug cartels, for instance. This is more complicated in Mexico, but it definitely did not exist in the Netherlands. There is no territorialization. Actually, a group of drug smugglers tries to keep its personnel as small as possible in order to detect or to evade detection by law enforcement. And that means that you actually have a lot of competitors on the market. So there is no incentive there to monopolization and to increase prices. And in the case of the Netherlands, it's also a fact that because the Netherlands have become a central hub of the drug trade, many drugs go through the Netherlands. And what stays here is often, or is produced here, is often much cheaper than in other countries, for instance, in England or in Scandinavia. So the model of the illegal drug market, which is based on this organizational criminal energy, has actually led to easy access to the market for suppliers, to low prices, and to, I would say, a complete lack of the monopolization expected by earlier researchers.
Yeah, intriguing. So you said that the high competition keeps the prices down, and that it's actually very hard to take the, so to say, the key players out, because it's actually about the opportunity structures that are offered and not so much about the individual players.
Yeah, well, or you could say it otherwise. You can take the so-called key players out, and that has been done in the past, or they have been killed by for one reason or other by other criminals, such as, for instance, famous drug lords in the past, as Klaas Bruinsma of Tjung Mon, or today there's also some violence between drug suppliers. But they are not key in the sense that they actually control the markets. You see that they always get their successes, that new players can enter the market.
Yeah, I see. Maybe a tangentially related question. So in the aftermath of the different instances of prohibition that you relate in the book, every time you see this moment of prohibition, subsequently, it's quite common to see that the demand also grows. The mechanism behind this this growth of demand seems a bit different every time. Sometimes it incorporates cultural rebellious elements. In other cases, it seems to be driven by supply. Do you see a general trend in these different increases of demand?
Well, the most general trend is, of course, the misconnect between the drug regulation by the state and what actually takes place in the field of drug markets and drug demands. So our normal idea of prohibition is, like America in the 1920s, there was a big alcohol problem, and prohibition was a way of dealing with that, although we can have a discussion about the extent to which that worked. But in the Netherlands, the drug laws actually were instigated before drug demand really developed. And that is because the Dutch drug laws were primarily instigated because of international developments. So you see at the end of the 19th century that there is a tendency towards an international regulation of certain drugs, which is led by the United States and China. European countries weren't too enthusiastic about it, but also because they produce these drugs themselves, either at home or in the colonies. But when Germany lost the First World War and the United States more or less became a dominant superpower, from then on, it's more or less obligatory for a government to play along in this drug regulatory regime. But if we look at the great changes in the drug laws, we see it again and again that the drug market only expands after the drug is prohibited. So it happens in 1920 when opium, heroin, and cocaine are made illegal under the drug laws. It happens after 1953 when cannabis, the use of cannabis is prohibited in the drug law. It happens after 1966 when LSD and other hallucinogens are prohibited in the drug law. And it happens again in 1988 when MDMA is prohibited in the drug law. And you see there is almost a misconnect between these regulations and what actually happens in society, where large social and cultural groups take up these drugs, irrespective of whether they are not controlled in the drug laws, and the market expands, and therefore suppliers also see a way to make profit and also expand their activities. Nowadays, it goes a little bit the other way with these new psychotropic substances which enter the market, but which are actually a kind of a response to the drug law. So you prohibit a drug, then people make a drug that looks like the drug, but is not yet prohibited, that has to be prohibited again. So we have now this whole cycle of increasing demand for regulation. But throughout the first 70 or 75 years of the drug laws in Netherlands, it was always the other way around. The drug was already prohibited, and then it came on the market.
Okay, so you wouldn't say that there's necessarily a causal mechanism between prohibiting a substance and it subsequently becoming popular. You just say that there is no connection at all.
I would say there's no connection at all. You see, of course, in from the 1950s onward that many people, the more or less illegal status of the drugs, the fact that you have to go to places more or less out of control of the state, may have added another spice to using these drugs. So that's also often an argument against prohibiting them. But actually, I think that was not never such a big deal. drugs have a function in our society. They have a function for certain social groups. And the development of this function has not been directed or regulated by what happens to the drug laws.
Yeah, intriguing. What I find a fascinating moment in time is this romanticized period of the music festival in Kralingen, which is, well, for our listeners, sort of Dutch Woodstock, with its like mythology. And I'm fascinated by this festival and its relationship to the Dutch take on cannabis, the Dutch authorities' take on cannabis. And with an eye on subsequent Dutch drug regulations, so coming after mid-60s, would you say this festival was a kind of a turning point in the sense of this turning an eye policy of the Netherlands that we currently have towards marijuana? Or was this handling of cannabis at this specific moment more an image of the underlying currents in Dutch culture and Dutch policy?
Well, you can see Kralingen as an expression of what is a turning point, and that is the realization not only that there are increasing number of users of illegal drugs at the time, especially cannabis we're now talking about, but also that the users of this cannabis were not people from, let's say, marginalized communities like ethnic minorities or the lower classes, for instance. Now, the users of this cannabis were very much middle-class users. And this realization dawned in the first half of the 1970s. And posed the regulators for a very distinctive problem, because taking a hard stance about cannabis use in what was in effect their own children or children from their own social classes would alienate these children even further from the society they grew up in. So, and it's also personified, for instance, that the Minister of Public Health in the cabinet that changes the drug law and makes the distinction between hard and soft drugs, which in the Netherlands meant that the use of cannabis was decriminalized. And the Minister of Public Health in that cabinet had a son who was actually one of the most vocal exponents of the positive benefits of cannabis use. So you see, it's almost like Kralingen and the explosion of a what you can call a hippie subculture in which many people started smoking. This led to a typical Dutch phenomenon, which meant looking for a compromise. And the compromise was actually that so the cannabis use gets decriminalized. That means that we don't have to persecute our own children who are smoking cannabis. On the other hand, to make people happy who are against drug, we increase the punishments for hard drugs, and we also make another drug, amphetamines, which was until then not included in the drug laws, a hard drug. And in such a way, we have a new compromise in which we can continue functioning in the Netherlands.
That's fascinating. If I may interrupt, so wasn't it the case that amphetamines were at that time quite normalized? Weren't those sort of normalized also among non-marginalized groups?
Amphetamines came on the market in the 1940s during the at the end of the 30s, but more and they became more popular during the Second World War. They were taken by all kinds of people, not just drug users, but students who wanted to study for their exams to increase their concentration, truck drivers who needed a drug to keep awake when traveling, people who went to a party, drove back, and took amphetamines to stop the effects of the alcohol. There's also a lot of incidental and anecdotal material on the use of amphetamines in sports. For instance, the famous football teams of the early 70s seem to have been richly doped with amphetamines. So the same goes for the cyclists. So amphetamine was not really what we would call a drug which is taken by junkies and all kinds of people you have a negative image of. Amphetamine was very much in Western culture, and it has actually been regulated first in the economic laws to prevent it being traded to other countries, and later in the drug laws, on the request of Sweden, which developed developed quite an amphetamine problem, prohibited amphetamines, and Dutch criminal entrepreneurs took their chance, smuggled amphetamines to Sweden. So this led to another international pressure on the Netherlands and to the illegalization of amphetamines. Which also meant that the Dutch government could say, okay, we have made cannabis into a soft drug, but see what we do with other drugs, which are a problem in other countries.
I see, fascinating. Maybe back to the supply side. In the book, you mentioned several instances of corporate non-compliance throughout the 20th century. Would you say that this is something typical for the Dutch situation, and is there a historical case of corporate non-compliance regarding drug trade, drug distribution that particularly struck you?
I'm not sure if it's a typical Dutch phenomenon. I think the main thing you have to realize is that whatever else illegal drugs are, they are trade. They are objects to make money with. So if you are a trading nation and there's a lot of money to be made with these illegal drugs, what would be really remarkable is that you didn't have the phenomenon that all people try to find corners in the laws, to cut corners, or what is the English expression, to make some kind of profit from these drugs. And you see from the beginning that it is everywhere. So the pharmaceutical companies who are no longer allowed to sell their drugs for non-medical purposes, they try to find ways to still make a profit. People who work for them take their expertise into illegal markets. And that is the 1920s, but you see in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, chemical companies delivering precursor chemicals for the illegal industry, maybe not explicitly being told by the people who buy these chemicals that it is for illegal purposes, but definitely also not asking about it. So what one doesn't know doesn't hurt. I guess you can find this. This book is, of course, about the Netherlands. I guess you can find it in other nations as well. But it's very much about a key part of the image of the Netherlands, that we are a trading nation. So trade is what fuels us. Trade is what has made us wealthy. At least that is the idea. So, okay, the illegal drugs are regulated. Some people abuse it. On the other hand, there were times when they were not regulated. So, you know, we can make a little side profit. The same goes for certain transport companies who allow drugs to be carried in their vans from Morocco or from Turkey. The same goes, of course, for people who look the other way to renters who construct an illegal drug laboratory on a farm in, say, the south of the country. So it's all trade. You're not too much involved with the nasty side of things. So why wouldn't you make a profit? Because else you would be more or less what we call a thief of your own wallet. And I think that's very much attention also in the Dutch cultural identity. And you see also from the beginning that, and it's still a big problem, that you don't want to tackle the illegal drug trade in such a way that you damage other trade flows. So a lot is going on in the port of Rotterdam. It's one of the greatest hubs for illegal drugs in the world. Has been for decades, but you can control every ship if you want it, but that would mean that you really damage your own economy, your own trade flows. So even when you are fighting the drug trade, you must always make allowance for the key business of the Netherlands, and that is that trade in itself must go on.
Yeah, makes sense. Those are the dilemmas of a trading nation, I guess. Beyond the native Dutch, there were also many, many other nationalities, countries, ethnic groups involved in smuggling drugs to and through the Netherlands. And some have been very much embedded in Dutch society, while others were at a distance. Could you maybe explain to the listeners what have been the different approaches of all these groups? How, if at all, did they connect with the Dutch, for instance?
Yeah, so I make a distinction between two non-native kind of groups. The first are the groups who are embedded in migrant communities. Who came to the Netherlands in the 20th century. So the original example are the Chinese. They come to the Netherlands just before the First World War. They are at that time often employed by the shipping industries. That's when you get these Chinatowns in cities as Amsterdam and Rotterdam. And a lot of these Chinese in their culture were involved in smoking opium. That was part of their way of life. And when opium was forbidden in the drug laws, the Chinese sailors kept on continuing to ensure that the flow of opium to consumers in the Netherlands continued. And the Chinese kept themselves at that point very much apart from the Netherlands, so had their own, their own lodging houses, their own opium dens, their own gambling houses. But they sometimes they would allow a native Dutch to buy some opium. But they were very much in a physical way present in the Netherlands. So for the smugglers who wanted to get opium into the Netherlands, the Chinese who had family connections, for instance, between China and the Netherlands, were already very much present, and they could use their global connections to smuggle the drugs. And that started in the 1920s, but the whole heroin epidemic of the 1970s is also supplied by these Chinese networks spanning the globe, as it were. But you also have smugglers from communities who are not embedded in Dutch society. So, for instance, the Greek drug smugglers of the 1920s, and perhaps more telling, the Colombian smugglers of the of cocaine around 1990, they could not rely on the existence of a large Greek or Colombian migrant community in the Netherlands. So what you see is that they are actually, they're sending envoys, they're making deals with either native Dutch or other ethnic groups who are embedded in the Netherlands. And what is what struck me about it is how very opportunistic and pragmatic these groups are. So on the one hand, they are very much organized along their own ethnic lines, work for a great part together with their own countrymen or people from their own migrant communities. But on the other hand, they are very much capable of making alliances if necessary. For instance, if you want to smuggle cocaine to Europe, you do not have a large migrant community, you don't have family living there, so you make contact with local criminal entrepreneurs and in such way ensure that the trade flows keep on going.
Yeah, intriguing. That's quite the difference. There's also another group in the Netherlands, which is, well, more recently talked about, I would say, and that's the southern regions of the Netherlands itself. And these are often mentioned, as, especially when talking about synthetic drug production and trade. Could you tell us a bit more about the historical characteristics of this region that made it into such a such a fertile ground for synthetic drug production and smuggling?
There has been a lot of a lot of discussion of this, of course, in the Netherlands. There's a lot of talk of the existence of criminal cultures, of families going way back and engaged in all kinds of smuggling and other criminal activities. But I think the main point is that these provinces, Brabant, Limburg, but also Zeeland, are of course connected to other countries by land. So they have land borders. So they're already the most logical places in which you would expect large-scale forms of smuggling. And then they have certain specific forms of smuggling which are closely connected to historical developments. For instance, that is the prime example is the infamous butter smuggling of the 1940s and 1950s.
Yeah, of course.
Butter, real butter, is produced in the Netherlands, but not so much consumed in the Netherlands because the Dutch preferred the more cheaper margarine, so the fake butter. But in Belgium, people want to have the real thing. Only in Belgium, the costs of the butter are much higher than in the Netherlands before the coming of the European Union. So what happened was that butter was smuggled on an extremely large scale into Belgium And this work was carried out by the same kind of smuggler groups that we know nowadays in the amphetamine and ecstasy trades. In fact, we can, and I describe in the book also, the historical line which goes from the butter smugglers of the 1940s, of the 1950s, who were often financed by respectable people in their villages, who took a share in the cost of the operation in return for a part of the profits. They organized in such a way that they could break through the border barriers that the Dutch military police, the Maaisersee, had put up. This included things as armored cars in which to drive through police fences, stuff like that. Now, these smugglers, and they were in Brabant, they were in Limburg, they were also in Zeeland. At a certain moment, cannot make any profit anymore with butter smuggling because of the new European policies. So the end of the tariffs between Netherlands and Belgium. So they start to develop other practices. One of this is the illegal liquor distillery. So you make alcohol, which is not subject to excises and taxes. And some of them became very famous burglars. And these burglars at some point were so much controlled by the police who followed them around in the operation that they decided to move into the amphetamine smuggling into Sweden, which I talked about earlier. And one of the nice things was that in the illegal liquor distilleries, they could easily build them around to illegal amphetamine production laboratories. So, and this continues. So some of these people were also involved in the illegal MDMA production of the 1990s. Same story, the amphetamine labs, they change into producing MDMA. So there is actually a genealogy of this illegal underground drug economy producing and smuggling drugs that dates at least to the Second World War, or actually to the period between the world wars.
Yeah, that's intriguing. So again, as you say, as you said earlier, it's largely determined by geography, and then maybe with a hint of historical contingencies.
Well, I would say geography is one, but the existence of certain cultures is two. These two have to combine. And what do I mean? It's a culture. So in the Netherlands, but also in other countries, you have what I would call criminal cultures in which certain ways of behavior, certain values, certain ways of looking at the state and its laws is produced and disseminated, learned to new generations. And you see in the Netherlands that these criminal cultures and the cultures I mentioned in the south of Holland is one example, but the criminal cultures in the lower class districts of Amsterdam and Rotterdam are another example at the same time as the colleagues in the south move in into the amphetamine smuggling. These cultures move into the cannabis smuggling, for instance, in the early 1970s. You see that they have the culture ready to move into these markets. So I would say geography is one thing. The existence of certain criminal cultures is another condition for these markets to drive. And their ability to make alliances, for instance, with producers in other countries, but also with the kind of non-compliant upper world companies we just talked about, people who deliver precursor chemicals for your illegal lab, or fishermen who allow you to use their boats for smuggling cannabis from Lebanon to the Netherlands, things like that. These cultural factors are as much important as the geographical factors that you're all also on the right spot. For instance, the borders with Belgium or Germany, or the open sea in which you easily can smuggle into North Africa or the Middle East or Asia. These cultural factors are as much as important. And if you combine that with a last factor, an increasing demand, which you didn't even have to advertise for, it was just there, but you are, because of the factors mentioned, actually the ideal people to supply this demand.
Fascinating. Yeah, I understand. Would you say that this penetration of the upper world that you just mentioned, would you say that this has increased in the period that you were watching, that you surveyed in this book?
Actually, there is no way at all we can test such a hypothesis. So at the moment, I know there's a lot of research, for instance, in the port of Rotterdam about corruption among security personnel, etc. But we have no way of knowing how this can be established in any quantitative way over the past century. The only thing I can say is that from the very early start, you can already find evidence of corruption. You already find in the 1920s drugs on the market which had been seized by the police before. You already have in the 1920s police officers in Rotterdam who are photographed in the beaches together with Chinese traffickers on a day out, so-called. So I would say the market has expanded. So that would mean more people would be needed to have more people from the upper world would be needed to keep the market going. But I think the fact itself, that has always been around, at least since 1920. And I'm not sure if the functioning of these markets is in any way different. Or let me put it in this way. You need a certain amount of corruption to be able to have an illegal market going. And this has always been the case. It doesn't mean that the side effects, for instance, subversion of authority or anyway, are bound to increase. It's just a way of wheeling and dealing, and that's how the market functions. In the Netherlands, it's not so obvious as, for instance, in other countries. Certain countries where you know you have to pay a police officer something. But it does exist here. It was debated quite a lot also in the 1970s, 1980s. The big drug lords we talked about, like Chung Mon or Klaas Bruinsma, all they seem to have their own contacts in the police. So did it increase in any significant way other than it increased because the market has increased, if you understand my meaning? We just can't say. But I'm not sure that this is the case.
No, it makes sense. It's very hard or even impossible to quantify. Yeah, understandable. I think we're almost coming to the end of the interview. I've taken up already almost an hour of your time. Is there maybe, because the book is full of intriguing anecdotes and salient stories about individuals or groups, is there one that you find particularly funny or particularly meaningful, or perhaps one that you didn't know before you started researching the current book that you want to share with us?
Well, what I didn't know or didn't realize, what especially fascinated me was some of these people from the South in the 1960s, and especially a guy called Arno Mink, because he more or less epitomizes for me the dual faces of the criminal drug market. And what do I mean with the dual faces? It's on the one hand, it's of course an underworld which has its very nasty sides. On the other hand, there's also a kind of romanticized image of them. And some of these drug smokers cultivated this own image, but some of them also were giving it to the public. And Arno Mink is fascinating because when he was a burglar, he was the typical burglar that people idolize. So he only robbed the banks and never the people. And that's why he also gained the nickname of the Robin Hood of the South. And they had to be sent a public prosecutor from the west of the country, who had served, of all places, in the colonial Indonesia. He had especially to be sent to the South to make an end to the activities of this Robin Hood of the South and his gang. And in the meantime, you see that the people of the of Limburg, where he lived and operated, actually didn't mind his activities so much, kind of laughed about setbacks for the banks or for police officers who came from Holland, the west of the country. And this is actually a kind of cultural image which he takes into his further explorations of, for instance, the amphetamine trade. And you see that a lot of these smugglers and criminals also try to create such images for themselves. Perhaps you know that a lot of the way criminals behave and act and start doing is very much influenced by one movie, The Godfather. People even calling themselves like they're called in The Godfather. Criminals in Japan changing their hairstyle because of this movie. You see today still that these famous criminals who are now prosecuted, had the one people who are caught in Dubai, sent back to the Netherlands for prosecution. And they also have this fantasized images of famous drug lords. So this kind of anecdotes fascinated me particularly because they emphasize how not only these non-compliant companies, but often the public at large is very much ambivalent about these kind of criminals. And that's, of course, also because they actually perform an important function for us. They deliver our drugs to us. And a lot of people in the Netherlands use illegal drugs, even from the highest social classes. So they actually, rather than, you can see of them as a kind of parasites on society. But if you look at their positions in the economic system, they actually contribute to our trade economy and GMP. Although sometimes the side effects are too severe. And our double-sidedness about these kind of criminals is, for me, that explains for me the anecdotes about people like Arno Mink or some of his colleagues. For instance, you also have some guy who was called the Black Knight because he smuggled the butter in his black panzered armor car through the borders.
Fascinating images indeed, and a very, very ambivalent picture of them indeed, yeah. Well, I guess that was it from my side, and it's been super interesting. Thank you so much. One final question before saying goodbye. What are your upcoming projects? Is there anything for us that we can look forward to?
Well, I have actually two things in mind. I would like to extend my my history of drug smuggling and these criminal cultures until the present day. But I'm also have become interested in another form of criminal activity, and that is the illegal wildlife trade, which is also one of the biggest illegal trades in the world, with very negative effects on the survival of species. And I have the idea that the kind of analysis in this book also very much imply to the illegal wildlife trade. So this would be a direction I would like to go into in the coming years.
That's great. That sounds interesting indeed. And well, I'll definitely be keeping an eye on that. Once again, Professor Stefan, thank you for your time and have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.